Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
I absolutely believe that we need to have an independent investigation to understand about what was done, what processes were used and were not used.
The Anchorage Assembly wants to know how the city's former health director was hired with a fraudulent resume. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Republican candidates in the special election are competing for the same pool of voters.
They've really been focused on going after each other. It's sort of like a family feud situation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Anchorage Assembly is weighing its options following a report from Alaska Public Media and American Public Media showing that the city's health director fabricated many parts of his resume, including overstating and misrepresenting his education and military background. Joe Gerace has resigned as the head of Anchorage's health department, and Mayor Dave Bronson says his municipal manager and HR director are investigating Gerace's hiring. But at an Assembly Rules Committee meeting today, West Anchorage Assembly member Cameron Perez-Verdia says he doesn't trust the Bronson administration to investigate itself.
I absolutely believe that we need to have an independent investigation to understand about what was done, what processes were used and were not used. I think it's really important that all of the appointments that came forth under this administration be reviewed again, and that we know the facts.
During the meeting, members of the Assembly compiled questions they wanted answered about Gerace's hiring. They boiled down to 3 main issues: how Gerace was hired with a fraudulent resume, what happened as a result of his hiring, and what could be done to prevent a situation like his from occurring in the future. The Assembly is also exploring the legality and practicality of vetting mayoral appointments themselves. During the meeting, one person gave public testimony. Barbara Bachmeyer says as a veteran, she was appalled that Gerace would lie about serving in the military. Gerace had claimed he'd served in 5 combat tours and was a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard, both of which he later admitted were not true.
And so the bottom line that I assert right now is that somebody needs to be fired, and that somebody needs to be the HR director. I don't know how that process can go, but he has shown that he is a derelict in the duties that are ascribed to that position.
There were no members of the Bronson administration present at the Rules Committee meeting to answer questions. One of the selling points of ranked choice voting is that it's supposed to make elections more civil. Yet, as Alaska nears its very first ranked choice vote, the special election for U.S. House, the two Republican candidates are attacking each other. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
In theory, candidates of similar politics would not want to alienate each other's supporters. In San Francisco, where ranked choice voting is used in local elections, rival candidates even campaign together for mayor, each endorsing the other as the number 2 choice.
Let's stand together.
Vote for me and Mark Leno.
Vote for me and Jane Kim.
But in Alaska, Republican U.S. House candidate Nick Begich's ads don't sound like that.
Sarah Palin is a quitter.
She's a quitter. She quit on us. She left us. She abandoned us. We picked her to do a job and she didn't bother to finish it because she wanted to go out there and get rich and famous.
In an interview, Begich sounded even less generous, saying Palin isn't the right personality to represent Alaska.
Self-aggrandizing, uninformed, intellectually discurious, and empty rhetoric would be some of those qualities.
Palin says she quit the governor's office for the good of the state in 2009 because she was beleaguered by the media. In a tele-rally, Palin said Begich is, quote, full of bull, and she says he's running for office all wrong.
It's funny because he clearly hasn't allowed ranked choice voting to impact the way that he negatively campaigns, as one would expect. When you're counting on second choice votes, it's the strangest tactic that he has. I think he's very confused.
Palin says Begich hasn't been a warrior against tyranny. She calls Begich a rhino, Republican in name only, in part because he supported Democratic candidates in the past. So even in this supposedly less partisan election system, evidence of bipartisanship is a weapon one Republican wields to hit back at another. Begich says for him, the odd part about Alaska's new election system is that the primary no longer ends fighting among Republicans.
Traditionally, we would have our intra-party debates and discussions through a primary process, and only one winner would emerge and proceed to the general election. Today, we don't have that opportunity.
Both conservatives in the race would like each other's supporters to rank them as a second, but there's a more immediate concern. Republican consultant Art Hackney is working for Begich. He put it this way.
Game number one has to be that you don't come in third, because if you come in third, you are, you know, moot to the whole thing, and it becomes your second choice votes that are the things that matter.
Several research studies suggest ranked choice voting does sometimes produce less political rancor. But Jeanette Lee, Alaska researcher for a think tank called Sightline Institute, says Begich and Palin are vying head-to-head for the same pool of voters.
They've really been focused on going after each other. It's sort of like a family feud situation.
It actually is a family feud. Begich is holding an Election Eve fundraiser at the Wasilla home of Jim and Faye Palin, Sarah Palin's ex-in-laws. If ranked choice voting is taking any venom out of the race, it's most evident in the campaign of Mary Peltola. The Democrat takes selfies with her rivals at every opportunity and posts them on her social media accounts. Peltola says she had a great time walking in the Golden Days parade in Fairbanks last month, beaming whenever she saw an attendee with a Palin or Begich sign.
And I think they were surprised to see me smile and get excited that they had a sign, you know, as an opening for me to say, hey, you know, good choice. Please think of me second.
Peltola says the voters seemed so startled by her approach that they took it as humor. But she says she does have a lot in common with the Republicans in the race on national security, concern for the economy, and the need for development projects.
All three of us understand Alaska has to continue to pay its bills, and we are a resource extraction state.
Begich and Palin smile for her camera when Peltola takes her selfies with them. They apparently don't see any value in attacking the lone Democrat in the race. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A committee of the Alaska legislature voted unanimously today to spend another $50,000 on its investigation into the firing of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Director Angela Rodell, bringing the investigation's total budget to $150,000. The Alaska Beacon reports Anchorage Republican State Senator Natasha von Imhoff, the chair of the House Senate Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, said the money is needed and she expects a full report in October. Members of the committee hired a special investigator in January to determine whether political factors played a role in the December firing of Rodell by the corporation's board of trustees. The corporation manages Alaska's $78 billion permanent fund, and a transfer from the permanent fund to the state treasury accounts for at least half of the general purpose revenue used for services and permanent fund dividends. Rodell's firing came after the corporation's most successful year on record, and Rodell said at the time that she believed the firing was motivated by Governor Mike Dunleavy's proposal to spend more from the permanent fund than allowed by a 2018 law. The committee's investigator, Howard Trickey, is employed by the law firm of Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt. In an August 9th memo, the firm said it had exhausted the $100,000 previously allocated by the Budget and Audit Committee. The additional $50,000 approved today includes a 15% reserve and is expected to be enough to finish the investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dip netting brings crowds and their trash to Kenai Peninsula beaches. Now volunteers are cleaning up.
So right now we're at 754 pounds of trash, and we're hoping to hit 1,000 before the end.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Juneau police have identified the crew member that went missing off a cruise ship in Juneau waters on Monday night. Police say it was a 31-year-old man from Tennessee named Lorenzo Anthony Holmes Jr. Police say he was an entertainer on Holland America's Koningsdam, where he worked since May. Authorities say video footage shows a person climbing over the ship's railing. Eyewitnesses aboard another cruise ship in port saw something fall into the water, followed by calls for help. Holland America said on Tuesday that it was likely that the man went overboard intentionally. The Coast Guard searched the area but didn't find anyone. Juneau Police Lieutenant Craig Campbell says for now, the incident is being treated like a missing person case.
Without a body, you know, there'd be nothing to go to medical examiner's office. They wouldn't make any ruling.
Campbell says because the eyewitnesses and ships are in motion, investigating will take some extra coordination. Holland America says it is offering counseling services to affected team members and guests. Also, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available by calling or texting 988. That's 988. The families of four cruise passengers killed in a floatplane crash near Ketchikan last year are suing Holland America Line. They're also suing the floatplane operator and the estate of the pilot. The families accuse the cruise line of pressuring floatplane companies to operate unsafely and failing to warn passengers of the risks. KRBD's Eric Stone reports.
Just over a year ago, a bright yellow and blue De Havilland Beaver floatplane crashed into treetops on a steep slope in Misty Fjords National Monument Wilderness. That's about 12 miles northeast of Ketchikan. The incident killed the pilot and all five passengers aboard, who had arrived in the region on the Holland America ship New Amsterdam. Now, families of four of the passengers are suing Holland America Line. An attorney for the families, Heather Cover, said the cruise line was required to inform passengers that floatplane tours could be hazardous.
Under maritime law, Holland America has a duty to warn its passengers of known dangers. And here, where the seaplane accident occurred, actually has a pretty prolific history of seaplane crashes and deaths.
She's referring to the fact that at least 21 people have died in plane crashes in the area in the past 7 years. That includes a 2015 crash that killed 8 people.
In that case, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, had actually written a letter to the cruise ship industry, including Holland America, warning that the schedules of the cruise ships could actually be contributing to this dangerous condition whereby you are having so many crashes and fatalities.
The NTSB found that the operator in the 2015 case, Promac Air, had a culture that encouraged pilots to fly in hazardous weather, in part because of scheduling pressures from cruise lines. But unlike that crash, Holland America says the 2021 floatplane tour wasn't sold or advertised by the cruise line. What caused last year's crash isn't clear. The NTSB's Clint Johnson said the agency is reviewing its final report and expects to release it soon. But search and rescue aircraft and other nearby pilots reported poor visibility and low clouds around the time of the crash. The families are also suing Southeast Aviation. That's the small family-run carrier that operated the fatal flight. Cover, the attorney for the families, says the company didn't do enough to make sure the pilot was good to go after a prior accident.
Just a couple weeks before this incident, the pilot was taking off and actually ran into a buoy and flipped his plane. He was taken out of rotation for a couple weeks and then came back, no additional training, no nothing. It was just kind of a matter of if he felt that he was able to come back to work, then he was permitted to do so.
Southeast Aviation did not return a call for comment. The pilot, Rolf Lanzendorfer, had worked for Southeast Aviation seasonally since 2015 and had logged about 8,000 hours flying similar aircraft. His estate is also named in the lawsuit. The plaintiffs accuse him of failing to account for poor weather conditions. The families are seeking unspecified monetary damages in the wrongful death lawsuit. Holland America, Southeast Aviation, and the pilot's estate are due to file their responses in court later this month. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, high fuel prices are forcing residents and villages to make tough compromises. Prices in the region typically range from about $6 to $9 for 1 gallon of unleaded gasoline, and heating fuel prices are even higher. KYUK's Olivia Eberts and Will McCarthy talked with people in three communities to hear how those decisions are impacting them. First, Olivia Eberts checks in with people filling up at a gas station on the Yukon River.
100 miles from the mouth of the Yukon River in St. Mary's, the Crowley Fuel Tank Farm sits tucked into a spruce grove at the base of a big hill covered in blueberry bushes. Francis Beans, better known as Chunky, kicks up a cloud of dust with his red four-wheeler as he pulls up to the pump.
The gas is $8.85 a gallon. It went up about 2 weeks ago.
He starts to fill up, but a little leaks out.
Well, it looks like I'm spilling. Oh.
Drop
in this economy.
Yeah, you can't. Well, I just did. Maybe 85 cents worth. I'm not sure. It's going to be a tough year, especially in winter. The price of heat and fuel is way up there, too.
Bean says he plans to rely more on his wood stove this winter to help keep his bills down. He finishes fueling up.
We've got 2.2 gallons for $20.30. We're going to do a lot of walking this winter. Save a little and stay in hell.
Stories like Chunky's are common in the YK Delta. All across the region, high fuel prices are altering people's lifestyles and forcing cities to ration fuel and make sacrifices. Even as gas prices have begun to fall nationwide, communities in Western Alaska can still expect to pay a premium in the coming weeks. That's according to Mike Poston with Vitus Energy. He says it's because in Western Alaska, communities rely on slow barges for fuel.
You have to look at how long it takes to get from point A to point B. It's, 60, 90-day supply line from the time product first starts moving to the time it ends up in the tanks.
That means YK Delta villages are still paying spring 2022 fuel prices, which were at record highs. The national average gas price has dropped to a little more than $4 a gallon. But in the YK Delta, people often pay twice that. Part of the challenge for communities reckoning with high prices is the unpredictability. Yaniac finance director Lenore Kamaroff said the quote for their upcoming winter fuel purchase was more than double what it was last year. She's cutting the town of Yaniac's fuel order in half.
It is a big strain, and it's hard to tell what the fuel prices are going to be, in the near future or even 3 months from now.
With half as much fuel available, the village is now facing tough decisions on what to prioritize. It's unlikely that Yaniac will be able to heat their fire department building throughout the winter, and the city's looking for help from other organizations to purchase more fuel. Charlie Lang, who works in Yaniac Public Works, said that on a more basic level, the high prices have made it difficult for folks to enjoy the summer.
Pretty much everybody cut down joyriding and stuff like that. Now they usually only go anywhere if it's necessity,
In regional hubs, prices are lower, but people are still having to adapt. Olivia Eberts was at the Delta Western gas station in Bethel on Wednesday.
At the pump in Bethel, it costs $6.73 on the gallon to fill up. Scott Campbell is the manager of Bethel's trailer court. His team runs a fleet of 7 maintenance vehicles that they need to regularly fill up. He's putting about 18 gallons of gas into one of their pickup trucks right now.
Well, this time it was $123. I've had it be 200, so that's small consolation that it's a little less this time. The only good thing is that it's a company truck and I'm not paying it out of my pocket, so.
He says because of the high gas prices, he's had to cut back on the number of trips his maintenance team can take. He says he's not yet considering raising rents to offset the cost of gas, but that could happen eventually.
If it continued for a long period, then we'd consider it.
In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
And I'm Will McCarthy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 45 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The commercial catch of pink salmon in Southeast Alaska is already looking better than harvests in 2020 and 2018. After the first week in August, the commercial harvest surpassed 9 million fish combined for all gear groups. The region's purse seine fleet caught most of that, or around 8.2 million fish. Andy Piston is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Pink and Chum Salmon Project Leader for Southeast.
The last two even years, we only harvested 8.1 million fish in both those years, so we're already passing that, and we have a seine opening going on right now, and once we get numbers from this opening, we should be well above the last two even years.
Going into the season, the managers forecast a total catch of 16 million, with a range of 10 to 24 million. That still would be a weak run for the region, but would be around double the catch from the parent year 2 years ago. Meanwhile, hatchery chum salmon returns around the region have met or exceeded forecasts. The total Southeast catch neared 4 million chums in early August. Alaska had its third most open jobs in a month this past May, according to the most recently available labor data. At 11.2%, the state's job openings rate was approaching double that of the U.S. as a whole. Both national and state numbers show job openings are still far higher than before the COVID-19 pandemic. State economist Dan Robinson says one of the main causes of Alaska's worker shortage is the number of baby boomers who decided to retire early.
A disproportionate percentage, an unusually large number of those people at the 60 plus age group said, we're out, we're done, we can afford it, stock market's been good, housing market's good, I can afford to retire now, and this pandemic thing makes work difficult.
Another sizable portion of those who did not return to the labor force post-pandemic were people in their 30s. Robinson attributes this to the persistent challenge of finding childcare. Alaska has also had more people leaving than moving to the state for the past 9 years. Robinson says people often make a move for a job or to improve their quality of life, both areas Alaska has struggled with over the past decade. He points to the instability arising from Alaska's government funding challenges.
We had a lot of years where we could just take the money from oil revenue and pay all of our bills. And for 10 years, some people would say 20 plus, we've struggled with, is it enough? Do we need to have taxes? Do we need to make changes to the dividend?
Robinson says that funding instability has come at the expense of many of the common amenities that would motivate people to move to and stay in the state.
Schools is such a big one. The universities had a tough time, so some of our students have left who would have stayed if the university had kind of the benefits of stability, some of those kinds of things. You think of in Southeast, the ferry system, and then, you know, crime, homelessness. You think of the things that parks, trails, the things that different people value.
The pandemic accelerated Alaska's worker shortage, but with so many older workers retired and not enough to replace them, Robinson says employers need to get used to this new labor market. Meanwhile, Robinson says one silver lining to the cloud of economic recession some see on the horizon is that if the economy takes a downturn, employers might be less likely to lay off the workers that were so difficult to hire. And whether Alaska's high job openings rate has continued is yet to be seen, as the state labor data on job openings for June and July have not been released. Dip netting brings massive crowds out to Kenai Peninsula beaches every summer. There's one local group making sure the garbage left over in Kenai and Kasilof doesn't outlast the anglers themselves. KDLL's Riley Board hit the beach with the Streamwatch team during their last cleanup of the summer on Tuesday and has this story.
When the dip netters head home at the end of the season, they leave a lot behind. Zip ties, toilet paper, sometimes entire campsites, tents and all. For 6 weeks during the summer, volunteers and staff from the Kenai Watershed Forum turn out, rain or shine, to the North Kasilof Beach at the mouth of the Kasilof River to clean up the non-natural materials left on the beach during the fishing season. August 9th was the last Streamwatch day of the summer.
And we walk up and down the beach and try to remove as much trash, as much waste, as much of anything as we can that's not natural on the beach.
That's Kevin Duffy, a Streamwatch intern through the Kenai Watershed Forum. He's armed with a long grabber reacher and a bright yellow bag filled with what he's found so far this afternoon. Streamwatch was founded in 1994 by anglers who wanted to protect the wild salmon habitat in the Kenai area. This summer alone, Streamwatch has collected more than 700 pounds of trash at the Kasilof site. At the start of Tuesday's session, Duffy says he anticipated reaching 1,000 pounds.
So right now we're at 754 pounds of trash, and we're hoping to hit 1,000 before the end.
Duffy says the cleanup season started out slow, but by week three, they realized they needed to set their expectations for each haul a little higher.
Next. So the most we find is cigarette butts, I would say. After that, Capri Sun wrappers, just the straws. So those we find upwards of 100 a day, usually. And then zip ties as well, like right here. Zip ties.
Cigarette butts aren't just the most commonly found item. They're also of particular concern to volunteers like Marilyn Albright, who has been with Streamwatch for 3 years. She says most of the time, she can find over 100 cigarette butts in one evening. Cigarette butts are eaten by birds, so it's critical that they're collected. Albright also enjoys the company.
I really enjoy meeting young people who are interested in all of this, and they're just really a joy to be around, and they're doing jobs that are really worthwhile, and I really like that. That's a really good thing. There's hope for us all.
Beyond cleanups, the Streamwatch team is also working to get ahead of the trash issues before they happen. They have informational booths at active dipnet sites to teach anglers about reporting requirements and watershed stewardship. And this year, for the first time, they set up a booth at the Kasilof fishery. In Kasilof, I'm Riley Board.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Liz Ruskin and Michael Finelli in Anchorage, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Olivia Eberts and Will McCarthy in Bethel, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Riley Board in Kasilof. Our audio engineer tonight is Ammon Swenson. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.